This week's Tour Guide Tell All starts a new series we'll have throughout May in honor of the 75th anniversary of Victory Europe Day on May 8th. We'll have episodes about key figures and sites around Washington, D.C. in World War II history. From tonight's discussion about Winston Churchill to World War II spies, and we'll talk about the soon-to-be-dedicated Eisenhower Memorial here in D.C. Tour Guide Tell All is Becca, Rebecca, Dan, and me, your host and amateur sound editor, Candon. And we're all tour guides with DC by Foot. So in addition to our World War II themed podcast this month, you can check out Free Tours by Foot social media for videos and virtual tours. To start off, hashtag WW275FTBF. Oh, that looks a lot better than it sounds. Rebecca and Dan are here to briefly talk about Churchill. They were given a time limit because otherwise they would still be talking about him.
Welcome to another Tour Guide Tell All. I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Dan. Sorry.
We are super excited to have you guys back with us. This particular topic I'm going to be talking a little about Winston Churchill.
Oh, a small topic. We'll be done with this in like a couple minutes, right?
Manageable, yeah. And it might at first be a little strange. We are obviously Americans, and Winston Churchill obviously was very much not. But he does have a couple of DC tie-ins as well as American tie-ins, and we'll get to that in a minute. Winston Churchill is probably, of the topics we've done at least so far, the most well-known. He leads a very larger-than-life existence. He's very famous and visible, and by visible, I mean he's photographed everywhere. And there's a lot of writings about him. He leaves a lot behind. So there's a lot of information.
He writes a lot of stuff as well.
He does write a couple of books and a memoir. So he's very much, there's a lot. So we're not going to do all of that because we'd be here.
Because you could go read about it.
Yeah, because you can read about it. He's a super fascinating guy. The thing about Winston Churchill that always sort of strikes me is that he, if someone wrote his life story as fiction, no one would buy it because it's so ridiculous and unbelievable.
It's too much. It's too much stuff.
There's too many things. Too many things. He's born to privilege. He's in the Boer War and the First World War, and he's First Lord of the Admiralty, and he's Prime Minister. And he meets with kings and presidents, and he's just everywhere. But he is real, so that's good.
He is like the early 20th century. It's like Churchill. If you follow his life, you learn almost everything you need to know about the early 20th century.
Yes, basically, yes. And he's also really controversial, too. There is a school of thought that he's, you know, he has as many failures as he has successes. So many failures.
And that's one of the things that always drew me to Churchill when learning about his life is what a remarkable failure he is in many, many ways.
Yes.
And even after the triumph of World War II, he loses his next election as prime minister, right?
There's a historian that says, look, Churchill's famous because he gets one thing right.
Yep.
Now, granted, if you're going to only get one thing right, this is the one thing to get right.
This is the one thing. I'm okay with that, yeah.
But he, like, fails often.
And hard, yeah.
He has a couple of really low moments. And he's also a blatant imperialist, like... Mm-hmm. Comes right out and says it. He's a classist. He really enjoys the class structure in Britain that places him at the top. He's born, as I'm sure you're going to mention in a minute, at Blenheim Palace. He's the grandson of a duke. You know, so he's born to privilege. He's a hedonist. His drinking is legendary.
Off the charts.
off the charts. Scotch and champagne at the same time. Yeah.
Why not?
Lots of it. And he's a very ardent monarchist, which is great for Britain, obviously, but, you know, we don't really do the monarchy over here. So we don't want to do a standard bio. I'd rather talk about some vignettes from his life. And to start, one of the things that always tickles me most about Winston Churchill, who has been voted in several different polls the greatest Briton of all time, he was half American. Winston Churchill's mother, Jenny Jerome, was born in New York City. Her father was a financier, very, very wealthy. And Jenny's mother takes her and her two sisters over to England, and they're at a party. And Jenny meets Lord Randolph Churchill, who is the second son of the Duke of Marlborough. And they fall in love. And 3 days later, they get engaged. Like three.
So
days.
Very love, very fast.
Very fast.
Right.
And no one is pleased by this development. His family is like, ew, an American, gross.
And which is weird, right? Because his grandfather, I mean, the whole reason the Dukey exists or still existed and Blenheim Palace, where Winston was born, still exists to this day, is because I think it was the sixth Duke of Marlborough, the grandfather, Winston's grandfather, was like, I'm out of money. The Dukey is out of money, but I am of a certain class, so I can't work.
Yes.
So I'm going to go find me some money and marry that money. And he marries into the Vanderbilt family.
That's like his cousin. That's Winston's cousin, the ninth Duke.
Yeah.
Yes. So a generation later, they're all like down with marrying money. But Winston's grandfather's like, no, we're Americans. Plus the Jeromes are new money, you see. And you know, that's all very terrible. The Jeromes, for their part, they don't want Jenny across the ocean. This Randolph is kind of a ne'er-do-well. He's the second son, so he's not going to inherit the title. So what's the point of marrying the second son? You know, gross. And this is all very fast and kind of unseemly. And so the families kind of get together and are like, look, we don't want this to happen. So how do we prevent this? And so they say, well, a couple of conditions need to be met. And the most important of which is Randolph has to get a seat in Parliament within a certain amount of time. And all the factors align. Randolph gets a seat in Parliament. And about a year after they meet in April of 1874, Jenny Jerome and Randolph Churchill get married. Now, here's the interesting part about this. They get married in April. Winston, their first son, is born in November, which is how many months later?
2, 3, 4, 5. Oh.
Yes. And he's a full-term baby. He's a very large baby.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying, you know, but I'm just, that's all. We're just going to leave that there.
We're just going to leave that there. Yeah.
Yes. So Winston Churchill is born in Blenheim Palace. And Dan, you've been to Blenheim Palace.
Oh my gosh. I've been to Blenheim Palace many times.
Can you give us paint us a word picture?
it's an amazing place. It's actually, there's a sort of, I'm a big Elizabeth fan, Elizabeth I, and the second. Second's pretty cool too. But the grounds of Blenheim Palace were actually Woodstock, which is where Mary had imprisoned Elizabeth for like that brief little time. So I always found that to be really cool. It was, I think it still is the only quote unquote palace that is not connected to a bishopric or the crown itself. So it's like the only country town palace, I guess is what you'd call it. But it is a massive, massive thing. I mean, it holds true to its name. It is definitely a palace. It is a glorious building. And the grounds of it are beautiful and awesome. But you walk around there and you understand a lot more about Winston and that love of class and that love of monarchy. The Duchy itself was created, I believe, in the War of Spanish Succession. And so the land and the palace were given to the first Duke, or the palace was being built by the first Duke with funds from Queen Anne. So and there's this giant, beautiful statue of Queen Anne on the ground floor in the palace. So I always pictured myself as a little Winston, like running around there. And it's so, obvious why he is this classist imperialist with that, with running around there for even a little bit of his life.
Sure. I'd love, if I was at the top of the heap, I'd want to stay there too, man.
Yeah.
I've heard about Blenheim, and I have not been there, but I've heard that this is true, that they have a, it takes a year to wash all the windows.
Yes.
So you start and you work your way all the way around. And so your January windows, or February windows.
Yep.
And I don't know how the coronavirus is messing all that up. They're going to be behind. It's going to be terrible.
Yeah.
But that's the, it takes, that's how many windows and how large this place this is. Churchill's raised mostly by nannies. His mother is, and his parents are distant. He has this great quote about his mother, that he loved her, but from a distance. And he gets into all kinds of scrapes. The one of them, very early on in life, he decides he really wants to be involved in the Boer War. The Boer War, which is in South Africa. And Churchill gets on a steamer, and he's a young guy at this point. He's in his early 20s. And he gets himself a press credential, and he goes out to where the fighting is. But on the train is overtaken by the bad guys. He is taken prisoner, and he's put in a prison camp, and he has to escape through the latrine, like out the side window, and he runs away, and he's like a stowaway on a train heading towards the coast. He gets lost at one point and manages to knock on a door, and he's in enemy territory, and the door that he knocks on just happens to be this guy who's an ardent British monarchist and helps him out. Like, he is saved through complete chance, and that kind of defines the sort of early part of his life. He's very much he fly by the seat of his pants. He tells his mother that he knows he has a role to play, that he's going to be important in some way. He gets involved in Parliament, and he becomes First Lord of the Admiralty right before the First World War. And the First World War is not a great time for him. He has this very disastrous campaign that he spearheads called the Gallipoli invasion. And so he's forced to actually go to the front and be in the trenches in order to sort of save his reputation. But he remains in government. And on the eve of the Second World War, he is in the opposition in Parliament. And he butts heads frequently with the Prime Minister at that time, a man named Neville Chamberlain. And it's really interesting. Neville Chamberlain, if he's famous at all, it's for something called appeasement. Neville Chamberlain, during the crisis of the Czechoslovakia, when Hitler wants to take over Czechoslovakia, Neville Chamberlain basically says, oh, okay, sure, fine, go ahead. Do whatever you need to do.
It's just the Czechs, who cares?
Yeah, it's just the Czechs, who cares? Yeah. And Churchill's very critical of this. And the history has not been kind to Chamberlain, and has been very kind to Churchill in this moment, because what no one realizes at this time is we know now there's going to be a war, but Chamberlain ends up looking very weak. Churchill ends up looking very strong against the Nazi threat, and it propels him into being prime minister about a year or so later. So by the time the war starts, and for the British, the war starts in 1939, he is prime minister of Great Britain. And I also wanted to spend some time and talk about his love affair with Franklin Roosevelt.
And their broship.
Their broship. They're in love. It's a thing. They meet, actually, Roosevelt remembers this, but Churchill never does. They meet in the First World War when they're both young men. And later on, when they're president/prime minister, they meet again, and Roosevelt reminds him of this, and Churchill like draws a complete blank, which is like hugely embarrassing, because Roosevelt's, you know, politicians like to be remembered.
We've all been there too, right? And especially for politicians, right?
You meet so many people.
Forget a name, right?
Yeah, but like Franklin Roosevelt's just super embarrassed, and Churchill's super like, whatever, I don't remember you. And they form a fast friendship. They get along like a house on fire. Churchill and FDR, in both the ramp up to the Americans getting involved in the war and afterwards, they're very like-minded in terms of their goals for the war, but they're also like bros. Like, they like hanging out with each other. They dig each other in a big way. And one of the stories, and I tell this on my White House at Night tour, the United States gets into the war in 1941 at the end when Pearl Harbor is bombed in December. And Churchill is the only one who's really happy about this, because Churchill has been fighting the Germans by himself for a long time. And the Russians have been in the war for a few months, but he's really hoping that the United States will come and kind of bail out the British. And so Churchill immediately, after getting into the United States gets into the war, he immediately gets on a plane, flies across the Atlantic, and spends 3 weeks in the White House with Roosevelt, making, 3 weeks of high level strategy meetings. And he stays in the White House. They have a suite for him. Churchill has what I think we would describe with a sort of more modern sensibility. He has something called boundary issues.
And what, pray tell, do you mean by that, Rebecca?
What do I mean by that? So they're meeting every day, and they really, the Churchill and FDR are really getting along very well. And at one point, Churchill keeps very strange hours. He's up very late at night. Consequently, he's not really like raring to go at like 7 a.m. Like, he takes his time in the morning. And one late morning, Franklin Roosevelt gets what he thinks is a really great idea. And he can't wait to tell Churchill about it. And so he heads down the hall of the White House. And now, because it's like 11 o'clock in the morning, and frankly, this is Roosevelt's house, like, this is his home,
right,
he doesn't bother to knock. And so he opens the door, and Churchill is coming out of the bath wearing nothing but a cigar. Yeah. Not a euphemism. There really was a cigar.
No, it was a cigar there, yeah. Really, he was never without a cigar, even in the bath.
He was never without a cigar. Also scotch.
Yes.
So Roosevelt at this moment does what I think any reasonable person would do, which is cover his eyes and pray that the earth would swallow him whole. And he starts to like back away, and Churchill stops him, and he says, no, no, no. The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States.
One of my favorite Churchill quotes ever. I mean, he does some pretty nice speeches too, but
yes,
I think
that one's delightful.
That one's great.
Now, a couple weeks later, still on the same visit, the opposite happens. Churchill gets what he thinks is a really great idea. He can't wait to tell President Roosevelt. So he runs down the hall of the White House and he busts in on the president, except that it's 2 o'clock in the morning. And what is the president doing at 2 o'clock in the morning, Dan?
Hopefully sleeping.
Yes, he is sleeping. Get your mind out of the gutter. Alone, I might add.
Yeah.
But after being interrupted, he's not. This wakes him up. And at this point, Eleanor Roosevelt, the First Lady, who frankly finds Winston to be a little tiresome anyway, she puts her foot down and she says, the commander-in-chief needs a full 8 hours. And so she decides that the next time Winston Churchill comes to Washington, that he should not stay in the White House. She purchases Blair House, which is across the street from the White House, and gently suggests that maybe the prime minister would feel a little bit more comfortable if with his own house. Mm. Now, no, thank you very much. Churchill wants to be in the White House because that's where the action is. But
and for those who don't know, the Blair House is, but a couple hundred feet from the front door of the White House.
Yes.
It is right next door, yeah.
But it's not in the White House.
But it's not in the White House.
Right. And so Churchill wants to stay in the White House where the action is, but he's also not a dumb man, and he knows a hint when he hears one. So that is how Blair House gets purchased. And to this day, Blair House is where foreign leaders stay when they're in Washington. So he's the first one to stay there. And Churchill and FDR have this really interesting friendship. And Churchill's very much the sort of junior partner in this friendship. Despite the fact that he's older, he is the one who kind of courts Franklin Roosevelt. He's always, you know, asking for his advice, and Roosevelt being Roosevelt is very sort of cagey. Roosevelt keeps his own counsel, and there's an insecurity to Churchill that Roosevelt lacks. Roosevelt's very secure. He's very confident in a way that Churchill kind of isn't. And this carries right on until the end of the war, towards the end of Roosevelt's life. Churchill will tell Roosevelt that it's fun being in the same decade with you, which I just love. Just hilarious. And he says that Roosevelt is like opening up a bottle of champagne. Like, being with Roosevelt is like drinking champagne. It's the sort of friendship.
Which from Churchill, that is a high, high, high compliment.
It is a high compliment because he drank a lot of champagne.
Yeah, there's not much else better in the world
than champagne.
Than a bottle of champagne, yeah.
Yes. Also, shout out to our colleague, Becca, who actually used that quote in her wedding vows. And the war for Churchill, this is where he makes his reputation. He has these great speeches that he gives, and that's sort of what he's most remembered for. He gives these, the few, he really calls back to Shakespeare, to Henry V. And what he does with these speeches, he talks about, you know, never in all of human endeavor have so much been owed by so many to so few. And what he's talking about is the RAF fighters, the Royal Air Force fighters, who are defending Britain against the German bombers. And so to this day, they're nicknamed the Few. The guys who flew those planes are to this day. And in fact, the last member of the Few died about a year or so ago. So they are still known as the Few. And what he's doing, he's directly referencing Shakespeare, and he's referencing Henry V, and sort of calling back this moment in British history to the most famous of English playwrights and to the most famous of English kings, sort of these, you know, iconic medieval battles. And so that's kind of where he's situating the British. And what he really does with these speeches is really sort of underscore how this is a struggle for British survival. You know, he says that in the British Empire and its dominions last 1,000 years, they will still say, this is our finest hour. And so he's got this great big booming voice that just sort of carries, made for radio, you know, carries across and really provides a lot of stability and strength to all of these Britons who are really going without and suffering during the war. So he's really the sort of strong leader that.
Yeah, it always. Yeah, I think for me, this is also the greatest part of Churchill is, you know, especially us as historians, how he digs into the historic identity of Great Britain to almost, I don't know how to put this, but he this idea of the British stiff upper lip that, you know, keep calm and carry on, that was always sort of part of the British identity, looking into its history, but he encapsulates it and crystallizes it in these beautiful speeches that it really does. It is the identity of the British people, even to this day.
Yes.
And he creates that by digging into the history of his people. And I always just found that to be tremendously fascinating.
Oh, it's so, and he writes, so he, one of the books that he writes himself is The History of the English Speaking Peoples. Yeah. And he really uses a knowledge of history and a knowledge of sort of the British sense of themselves that really is very profound sort of in this moment. And in this war, that's really about who not only the British are, but who the Russians and the Soviets are, who the Americans are, how we conceive of ourselves as a people. And we're fighting, you know, the British are fighting for their way of life. And I always make this point to particularly American audiences, this war was on their doorstep in a way that it was not for the United States. And not that it was easy for the United States at all, but they're getting bombed. There's at one point, they decode the German code machine. It's called the Enigma machine. Yeah. And they decode a German message that says, we're going to bomb Coventry. And Churchill knows that this is about to happen, knows that they're aiming for this ancient cathedral that there are going to be a lot of deaths, but he can't tell anybody because he can't let the Germans know that they've broken their ciphers, because the intelligence that they're getting from that is so critical. And so he has to watch as the Germans indeed bomb Coventry, kill a lot of people, and he has to live with that for the rest of his life, that he could have saved these people and didn't. And so it's this really very...
And there's that famous picture of him right after. Yes. Like he knew it was going to happen, and he doesn't shirk away from it.
Nope.
He goes there, and he tries to comfort the people that he couldn't save. And I can't imagine what that was like.
No, and he still can't tell them at that moment that he knew.
Yeah.
Like, this only comes out after the war. He admits that he had broken their ciphers. And so it's really just – and the idea that they never held him responsible for that. Like, can you imagine if that comes out in the United States?
Sure. And I think it really is because of this sense of the greater good that he has in all of his speeches and all of his addresses to the people and to the commons. Mm-hmm. It really is about this greater good of the people of the nation, and that they are all sacrificing.
Yes.
And that was part of it, that even, it's horrible to say, it's horrible to think about, but that was a huge sacrifice.
Yes. Yes. And he has to this day, if you go to London, you can go to the Churchill War Rooms, and they're absolutely incredible. And you can see sort of, there's this underground warren of rooms where he would stay during the bombing. It's a couple of feet away from Parliament, so that he, you know, could be as close as possible to getting all of these, the intelligence reports and the bomb damage and things like that. And so he's really, you get the sense of how not only immediate this was for him, but how on top of it he was the whole time. Like, he's really very involved in sort of what's going on at a micro level for the entire war. Another great story about the war that I love about him is the British get involved in September of 1939. And the Battle of Britain takes place about a year later. And the British are fighting this war by themselves, which is not, I mean, we think of Britain today as just being this teeny little island. Back then, they had all their dominions. And, but still.
Massive empire.
But still, in Europe, it's the Nazis have taken over all of Europe. And the British are like on their own.
They pieced out after Dunkirk. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They pieced out after Dunkirk. And so the Soviet Union at that time has signed a neutrality pact with the Nazis. And so it looks like the Soviet Union is going to be completely neutral while this is all going on, until Hitler's greatest mistake on June 22nd, 1941, the Germans invade the Soviet Union. And Churchill is a hugely, stridently, vehemently anti-communist. Mm. Can't stand the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. However, he sends over to his foreign secretary, a man named Anthony Eden. He sends his butler over, knocks on Anthony Eden's door, and the butler says, with the prime minister's compliments, and he hands him a cigar, and he says, and the Germans have invaded the Soviet Union. Hands in the cigar. And then later that day, he talks in the House of Commons about this. And he says, talks about how anti-communist he is. He says, but, basically the enemy of my enemy is my friend. He says, if Hitler invaded hell, I would at least make a favorable mention about the devil on the floor of the Commons. So this is how sort of important and really very key this is. The other story that I love about Churchill and the war has to do with the king. Now, the queen today, Elizabeth II, was alive because she's been alive since the dawn of time. She was the heir during the war. She was a teenager. But her father, George VI, was king. And as we all know, because we all watch The Crown, the prime minister has a weekly meeting with the sovereign. Churchill did this too. And in the ramp up to the Normandy invasion, what we call D-Day, Churchill, obviously, as prime minister, was involved. And he informs the sovereign of this. And they discuss it kind of in their weekly meetings. And at one point, and it's not clear, I've read a lot about this, and I can't find who has this idea, whether it's Churchill or the king. But one of them has this idea that they should both be there for D-Day. Like, not on the beaches. Like, you know, they're not going to charge. Yeah, yeah. But they should be on one of the ships. Yeah,
but like Elizabeth II's, like, you know, right, the Spanish armadas coming.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
You know, they're there.
Richard the Lionheart, like, cheering them on in person, you know. And Churchill has served in the military. Even the king, he served in the Navy during the First World War. He was at the Battle of Jutland, the biggest naval engagement of the First World War. So he's got military training, and they both think this is a great idea. We're going to be there in person to, you know, provide this beacon of support, and it's going to be a great idea. And they're
so
like,
British.
So British. And they're egging each other on, like, this is going to be really great. And at some point, the queen gets involved in this. Well, we know as the queen mother, Queen Elizabeth at the time. And she thinks this is a great idea. Apparently, none of them have a lick of sense. And they this is a great idea. We're going to do this. It's going to happen. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. At some point, the king mentions this to somebody on his staff. And in my mind, because I've watched The Crown so many times, I want it to be Tommy Lassells, who we all know and love. I don't know if it was. It may well have been. He was the private secretary. But in my mind, that's who I'm picturing. He mentions this plan to whomever. And apparently, this is the only person in the palace with any sense. Because he says, yeah, that sounds great. And immediately, like, turns around and calls up the Allied High Command and is like, so...
just want to let you know.
Just wanted to drop you a dime. This is what these idiots are planning. And so Eisenhower, who's the Supreme Allied Commander, is like, no. And so word gets back very quickly, this is not a great idea. And the king, to his credit, he folds pretty quickly. He knows his role. He's a constitutional monarch. Like, this is not his
role. Right. This is not a good idea. But also, like, this is a secret invasion.
Also, yes, that too. Right. Yes, this is secret. So the king folds and he says, okay, you know, my place is in London. Obviously, like, the emotional support I provide can come from health. But Churchill digs in, stubborn. He says, no, I am prime minister. I'm commander in chief. It is my right. I am, you know, the head of the British Armed Services. And this gets back to Eisenhower, and they go a couple of rounds about this. And Eisenhower says, no, you're not, no, you cannot be there. And Churchill digs in, and he's very stubborn about this. And eventually word comes from the Supreme Allied Commander that if the prime minister shows up, he will be bodily, physically, forcibly removed. They do not want him anywhere near this invasion. For D-Day.
And it's hard to, like, unless you know a little bit about the British military, especially at that time, it is still very classist.
Yes.
And all the upper folks are not necessarily upper folks because of their greatness in battle, but often because of their class privilege. And Winston certainly falls into that, both in World War I and World War II. Mm-hmm. So you really see the privilege that Churchill has.
Oh, God, yes.
And this class is like, no, no, no. What do you mean? No one says no to me.
No one says no to me. And Eisenhower is this, like, kid from Kansas.
Right,
like,
yeah.
No, dude, not happening.
Yeah, we're in charge here now. Thanks. Yes. Thanks for playing the download.
We'll take it from here.
We'll take it from here.
The adults have it. Thank you. And so it's this really, like, wonderful moment of, like, Churchill, like, wants to be there, and he thinks, and I feel like this comes to all people at some point, like, you're in your 60s and you still think you're in your 30s and, you know, you can charge the beaches at Normandy. But no, he does not. The end of the story is he does not show up for D-Day, and, you know, sort of pays attention from London as normally he should.
As a normal commander-in-chief today, in the 20th century.
FYI, in case anyone's wondering, this is my little bit of trivia for you. I looked this up especially for you, Dan. The last British sovereign to lead troops personally in battle was King George II.
Oh, I did know that.
In the 1740s. So there you go. That's my little
trivia tidbit.
So yeah, that's Churchill. He, after the war ends, and he immediately loses re-election. Which is outstanding.
People are done with him. People are done with the war. They're done with him.
They're over
and
it.
There's it's weird because it's not like there's an animosity or there's any blame. They just, it seems the people just want to turn the page and move on to the next thing.
He's not voted out of office, but he's just not going to be prime minister anymore.
Right.
And so he leads the opposition for a few more years, comes back to being prime minister, literally serves in as prime minister through a couple of strokes and very ill health into his 80s. And they basically, somebody has to sit him down eventually and be like, you're 85.
You need to go away now.
Go away now. And retire, like, you know, enjoy your retirement. And he literally like can't figure out how to slow down.
Yeah.
He makes speeches for the rest of like for a large part of the rest of his life. He continues to drink and never let anybody say that excess drinking is bad for health because he dies in his 90s. Like he's 90.
It is amazing. Yeah, he's 90 years old. What was that? 1965.
Yeah, 1965.
Which also it's also not that long ago for us.
He had one of the largest funerals to date in British history. Like I think it was the largest until Princess Diana died. Like it was absolutely massive. He's one of only two living people to be granted honorary United States citizenship.
Mm-hmm. Who's the other one?
Mother Teresa.
There it is.
Yes. There's a couple that have been posthumously like Lafayette, Marquis de Lafayette was given honorary U.S. citizenship. He was dead. Like Churchill gets it while he's still alive.
Barely. It's like 1963. There is the connection. I always use that as a connection to his statue here in D.C.
Because
he was granted that citizenship by President Kennedy. It's 1963. If you've ever seen the British Embassy here in Washington, D.C., it is quite decked out.
Largest embassy in Washington.
Yeah, it has expanded greatly over time. And today, it wasn't at the time. Actually, I passed that. No, 1970s. But it's right next door to the Vice President's house, the Naval Observatory.
Yes.
But in 1963 or 1962, I can't remember, 1962 or 63, that is when President Kennedy confers this honorary citizenship the day after they unveil this beautiful statue of him on the grounds of the embassy. And one thing we tour guides always like to point out is the fact that it sort of looks like Churchill is walking. And there's one other statue like that in D.C., which is Gandhi. And the artist there specifically wanted to depict Gandhi as a man of action. So that's why he sort of has Gandhi mid-stride. But with the Churchill statue, he's sort of that classic Churchill pose. He's got his arm outstretched. You can almost see him campaigning with the V sign, V for victory. And he has one foot in front of the other. And the artist in this case didn't want to so much say that Winston Churchill was a man of action, though he was. But his message with the statue was that Churchill was this man of two different worlds, having American parents or an American parent. And this special relationship with Roosevelt and how he cultivates not only this personal relationship, but really this national relationship, which has pretty much been the status quo since that time. So one foot is in sort of the British embassy territory and the other foot juts out into American territory. And he is this man of two different worlds. I always like the symbolism there.
I love the symbolism that is sort of bestriding the two worlds.
Yeah.
My other favorite Churchill statue is in London. It's right by the Houses of Parliament. It's sort of that sort of Parliament Commons right there by Westminster. And he's got this massive, larger than life statue, but it's electrified. He didn't want pigeons. He knew there would be a statue of him, but he didn't want pigeons to land and crap on his statue. And so there's an electric pulse. If anything is on the statue for too long, it gets a minor electric shock to let the pigeons know this is not where they're supposed to hang out. So they've got right in this square, there's a statue of Nelson Mandela and Abraham Lincoln and a bunch of other British notables, all of which have pigeon poop all over them. But Churchill's remains pristine.
I feel like we should tell the story, or just the brief story of the war rooms.
Do it.
I can't remember the date exactly, but it's sometime. So the war ends, and the last person out just basically locks up, you know, like goes home for the day,
mm-hmm.
and then no one goes down there for the next 30 decades, years or so. Decades pass. Nothing is done to this area. It's basically a time capsule. It's a giant time capsule. And I can't remember exactly when, but it wasn't until the 1970s that someone sort of found themselves down there. And they didn't have to do much to restore it. Mm-hmm. All the maps were up, all the tables were out, all the furnishings were there. They didn't do anything to it. They sort of had to revamp some things to make it a museum that it is today. But it's one of these, and to consider that it wasn't done on purpose, that mm-hmm. it wasn't be like, oh, we need to preserve this for future generations. But to have that kind of access to what Churchill physically and what others of the time were physically going through. And also to realize that there's no reason that didn't get bombed.
Right.
Like it was right in the center of London. There were bombs dropping all around it. They did try to reinforce parts of it like halfway through the war. But for the first 2 or 3 years, like any one bomb could have taken out the entire hierarchy of Great Britain, especially the military command. But today, that is one of the most awesome places for any history inclined person to see is these underground bunkers or the war rooms of Churchill.
Yes, highly recommend.
But back to what you're saying, I've seen that statue so many times and I never knew it was electrified. And it makes total sense now because I have witnessed and seen like, I wonder why they clean only this one and none of the other ones. I'm like, it's kind of a crappy thing to do, but that makes more sense. The electrified pulse also.
That's kind of what I had. Do you have any other Churchill information you want to?
I think I've sort of interjected. Like I said, we didn't want to sort of do a deep dive into Churchill because we would be here for, well, probably till next week.
Yeah.
But to sort of pull out those funny stories and to sort of give you a sense of the man that sometimes you don't pick up in the straight history. Like if you're just doing sort of the high school textbook, like Churchill is a great leader, but you don't get that he is sort of a slob, sort of a...
Very human.
Very
the
human.
Most that, human of
that is a great way to describe him. Yes.
Yeah, and if you're in DC, he's got to the DC sites. He's at the Blair House is still behind the White House where he was staying. Mm-hmm. There's also the British Embassy where his statue is kind of up there. So he's got a little DC flavor to him as well. But he's just so like very human. Experience in a way that I feel like FDR is kind of not. There's a human quality to Churchill that's just outstanding. Yeah.
I think there is a more human quality to FDR, but you got to dig. You got to, like, he hit it. And you got to really dig to find that. Whereas Churchill is in all his glory, naked as the day is gone, standing in front of the President of the United States, smoking a cigar. Like that, I think that is my favorite image, although I try not to imagine too much. My favorite image of Churchill. And really, I remember that transition in my mind from sort of my high school understanding of Churchill as just this, you know, super duper speech giver and grand strategist to this, you know, diving in deep like we've done tonight and finding out all these crazy human things about him.
Oh my gosh, he's so great.
And he's so much more fascinating and interesting because of it, you know?
Yes. And he really is definitely read biographies of Churchill. He's fascinating. Thank you guys for tuning in. This has been another tour guide tell-all. We are so excited to keep bringing you these. It saves our sanity during the quarantine period.
Well, thank you so much, Rebecca. I learned a lot.
Thank you, Dan. This was fun.
That's part of my favorite part of doing these. It's like, you know, we all know so much about these individual people and individual historical facts, but when we cross-pollinate, I think it's so much fun. Well, thanks, Rebecca. Until next time. Oh, this is Dan. I should say that.
Yeah, this is Rebecca. Yeah.
Bye, everyone.
Tour Guide Tell All is brought to you by the Guides of DC by Foot. You can support us by becoming a patron on our Patreon page, Tour Guide Tell All. You can also take one or many of our tours in person when you can or virtually online. We do private virtual tours with historic images and modern footage. A no-cost way to help us is to review our podcast on whatever app you're using to listen. From the Tour Guide Tell All team, Candon, Becca, Rebecca, and Dan, Thank you, stay home, and keep listening.